Hello, friends, and welcome to season two of the End Hits Records podcast. This is your host, Ozzy Ronsberger. This season, we will talk in depth about our next release, the reissues of the Better Than a Thousand albums, Just One and Value Driven. This is the first part of our interview with Better Than a Thousand drummer, guitarist Ken Olden. Ken has been the driving creative force behind some of Washington DC's most respected bands, including Battery and metalcore pioneers, Damnation AD. Hi, Ken. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you? Good to hear from you.
Really, really good. So we are here to talk about those Better Than a Thousand reissues we're going to do together. Yes. You, the band, and End Hits Records. And I wanted to ask you a few questions about those. And my first one would be because it seems like Graham Land and you have been, you know, the core and the main, you know, driving forces behind the band. Do you remember when you met Graham?
You know, it's funny you're asking me that. So let me think. I want to say it's about 1988. So quite some time ago. And the DC scene back then was extremely violent. I mean, it would have been 87 or 88. DC was extremely violent. You had this one huge skinhead gang that ran DC. I mean, just super scary, you know. And we would go to shows. Like the first time I actually saw Youth of Today was in right around when We're Not in This Alone came out. It would have been in 88. And believe it or not, back then you could actually have really huge hardcore shows. That show that Youth of Today headlined in 88 probably had 1,200 people at it. So, you know, you think, did hardcore get bigger or smaller? Back then, the reason the shows could be really big was because you actually had a lot of different groups all going to a hardcore show. So, for example, that show was Youth of Today, Adolescence. God, I can't quite remember all the bands, but it was a really interesting old school show where it wasn't just like straight edge bands. You could have like a punk band and a metal band. You could have a straight edge band. They'd all be on the same bill back then. So, but then the audience was the same. So you would have, you know, out of that crowd that was 1,200 people, there's probably, you know, 600 or 700 skinheads. Okay. Then there's probably like 200 straight edge kids, you know, and then there's probably like 200 punk rockers. And they're all at the show somehow enjoying this bill together. But it was very dangerous because the skinheads had everyone outnumbered, and you know, and there was some tough, mean-spirited people that kind of ran that skinhead crew. And so back then, going and let me say also, DC was an incredibly dangerous city at the time. I mean, at that point, it was called the murder capital. It had more murders per population, you know, more murders per 1,000 people than any other place in America. Because at that point you had crack happening and all sorts of inner city violence. So, and of course all the hardcore shows, they're not out in the suburbs where it was safe back then. They were all downtown and often in pretty bad parts of town. So it was really weird because just to get to the show, you'd have to kind of get through, you know, some tough, dicey neighborhoods. And most of these shows, there were some matinees back then, but a lot of the shows were at night. So, you know, you know, as let's say a 15, 16, 17 year old back then, you had to have a lot of street smarts to get to the show and then some street smarts to like survive the show itself. Because the funny part is that I could never really focus on the danger of Washington DC as the murder capital, because the shows themselves were so violent back then. And it was constantly people getting picked up by an ambulance. I mean, you would see just horrible, horrible acts of violence. And but at the same time, you know, you love this music and you just sort of accept that it's all part of this one scene. So to get back to answering your question, one of the issues that we were having in that period of time was that there were actually some Nazi skinheads that were trying to get into the scene and be one of these factions. And so I met Graham because somebody had organized one of these, and it was just like a meeting. It wasn't like, it really didn't have anything to do with the show. Someone organized an anti-fascist meeting, and it was somehow related to Sharp Skinheads, which you may know, that's the anti-fascist group of skinheads. And that meeting was at a public library in the Maryland suburbs, because at the time it seemed like more and more fascist skinheads were actually coming into the DC and Baltimore area out of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania had a problem for a long time, out of parts of New Jersey. So they had some pretty big skinhead Nazi groups coming out of the area. And so it was, in addition to all the other violence that I described, that was like more stuff to like have to deal with back in the late 80s. So I met Graham then. And then about a year after I met him or so, I started a band called Worlds Collide. Mm-hmm. And it was me and a guy named Zach. He was the drummer, and our singer had just moved. He was Tony Brummel from Victory Records' roommate. He had just moved to DC, and so there was a random hardcore show, and we see this new guy wearing a Chicago straight edge jacket. You know, we realize, hey, what's going on, man? You know, we just start talking, and he's very, very energetic, and he wanted to start a band. So we basically had the beginning of a band, and then we got Graham in that band. So he was in Worlds Collide, but very briefly, only for maybe like a year or maybe not even. And then he left Worlds Collide to go he moves to New York. He starts doing Shelter. So it was interesting. And then the craziest thing about Graham is that he grew up literally like a block and a half from me in the suburbs, which was really crazy. You know, like, and I knew him for a while before I realized that he's basically my neighbor. Like, he's just far enough away from the house I grew up for me to not see him. You know what I mean? Like, he's just, you know how it is
run into him, but
yeah. But I never would have run into him in the neighborhood. He's just far enough away. But if I know where he is, you know, it's like a 8-minute walk. You know what I mean? I mean, he's as close as you almost could be, but like, I don't see him. He's not like right down the street, you know, but,
so Graham, at that point, when he left to join Shelter, so he was obviously into Krishna consciousness.
Yes.
Was that part of your thing as well? Were you ever interested or involved?
You know what, when we were in it's probably 89, early 90, we were vegetarian at the time. We were definitely super into the animal rights and the socially conscious, the pro-environment, and treating everything around us with respect and, and appreciating life for all people. So we would go, my friends and I, and Graham was in that group. We would go to the Krishna temple that was in actually next to my suburb is another suburb in Potomac, Maryland. And they had a really great Krishna temple there. And so we would go and they would make these feasts. And this is back, you know, we didn't know anything about this and none of us were coming from a background of organized religion, but we would go and just listen to them talk about they talk about spirituality, but a lot of, you know, animal rights, and you'd have like the great vegetarian food, and it was a decent amount of hardcore kids that were at that time were going. And I just felt like I was not into the organized religious aspect of it. And I wasn't, I also, and I'm just speaking personally, I also wasn't at the time, well, even now, at the time, some of the people, I don't know if it's modernized or not, at the time, there was some, you know, they sort of had like the women and the men separated, mm-hmm. You know, there's sort of some old school religious ideas of, or at least that's what was being communicated back then gender roles, you know? And so I was, you know, but personally that probably has kept me out, you know what I mean? Cause I'm probably a little more liberal than they were back then. And again, I haven't, that was the only time where, you know, we go, you know, once a month or twice a month. And it was like, you're hanging out with your friends, you're eating some good food. And for the most part, the people that are talking are saying stuff we agreed with, you know, less on the organized religious part, less on the sort of gender roles, but a lot of stuff I loved. I mean, I thought, especially the animal rights stuff. So, so it was a positive place to be. And I never felt like anybody was like trying to, you know, brainwash us into anything other people could get into. And Graham, you know, for a while, he was very into it. And, you know, he's a good friend of ours and we respected that. And he got more and more into it. And, you know, and at the same time, he's a great musician. So that obviously led to him, because actually when Shelter first formed, they were almost living out of that temple. So it was really weird because, here I am, this hardcore kid. I grew up listening to New York. I mean, I grew up first listening to like British punk, but then, you know, New York hardcore. And then all of a sudden, you know, Ray Capo is living essentially in the next suburb over from me. You know, it's like,
when you got to meet Ray for the first time?
I would have met him back in at that first Youth of Today show. They were all accessible. So, but you know, it would have been just like any hardcore kid going and seeing a band that they listened to. But you know, I want to say that show that where they played in DC was about 2 weeks before We're Not in This Alone came out. So, you know, those songs were not out yet on that record, which obviously was a great record. But you know, it was interesting because they were up there talking about vegetarianism, and like when they were saying that, it was like people didn't even know what that word meant. You know what I mean? Like they were definitely ahead. You know, it was
so ahead of the game. Like
they were
a lot of things that we take for granted nowadays.
Absolutely,
they planted the seeds for that back then.
Yeah, because you need someone to get your mind thinking about that stuff. You know, because first you got to plant like a little seed, and then you know, logic may dictate you do the right thing, hopefully. But you know, that's a good example. You know, they were up there talking about vegetarianism to a crowd that a lot of the people had never even heard of that at one point, you know? So, so that was significant, but getting back to Graham, he was, he joined Shelter and he was a part of that, you know, they did that 7-inch.
So Graham was already involved that early on the No Compromise 7-inch.
Right, exactly. So Graham wrote the music on that song Free Will and that 7-inch. I mean, and then he was in the band long enough to even have started contributing to the Mantra record. Okay. So, I mean, you know, and then that, you know, he went from being in Shelter to starting Baby Gopal, which was also another, you know, Krishna conscious band. They had a lot of, they were more mainstream sounding, but they had like that British underground, and Graham really loved and, you know, a lot of that British sub, you know, mod and Shoegazer bands like Lush and Echo Belly and Stone Roses, like some of that stuff that was that predates the, you know, Charlatans. Some of that stuff that predates like the underground stuff that would have inspired bands like Oasis later, you know, yeah. But Blur and Ride, but all that early stuff when it was kind of underground, he was really into all that stuff. I mean, I was too, but he was way more so.
When did he come back into your life then? So he joined Shelter.
I would say Graham was doing all the Shelter stuff from like 93, 94. Then he starts Baby Gopal in 94. And I record them, I want to say sometime right at the end of 94, beginning of 95, I record the Baby Gopal record that came out on Victory. It was like a 7-inch. And so he's doing Baby Gopal. He called me up because, you know, we're still friends. We're still in touch. And when he went to record, I said, oh, dude, you got to come down here. So Ray came down with that session. So that was sort of the beginning of Better in 1000, because Baby Gopal, I'm going to say they were in the studio for maybe like 4 or 5 days, something like that. And they're all just sleeping over at, you know, I had a group house with some of my old buddies, and the whole basement was converted into a studio, and everybody just crashed there, you know? So, you know, when like they went to a hotel or anywhere, like, so there's a lot of downtime, you know, we're just hanging out and we're talking to each other and brainstorming different ideas. And one of the things that, came out of there was that was the first time, like, you know, it's just me, Ray, and Graham. We're listening to Baby Gopal and we're checking it out. We're talking about music. And at some point, you know, halfway in the session, Ray's like, you know, we should do a band. Like, he just said that. And you just think, this guy's in Shelter. Mantra is either recorded or almost finished at that point. And Shelter's huge back then. I mean, and, you know, obviously Youth of Today was huge before that. So it's sort of like, at the time, it seemed like it's, you know, it's a fun thought, but I mean, he has no time and there's no way. Well, you know, like, this guy didn't have time to do, you know, some hardcore band. And so we just, that was the first time we kind of, you know, laughed it off. And so we end up, I'm going to say about a year later, right around 95, 96, about a year, year and a half later, Graham has moved back to the area. I think Baby Gopal, I can't remember if they had gotten signed, but Graham left right as they got signed, I think. So all of a sudden they're on Tommy Boy, which was like a major label. So it was really crazy. But Graham, he just wanted to do his own thing. So he moves back to Maryland. And he just calls me up out of the blue saying he's back. And when he called me, it was like perfect timing. Because when Graham calls me up, we've just finished recording Until the End. But our bass player, this guy named Ben Chusett, he was on, at the time, like house arrest for some graffiti thing or something crazy. Like he was a big graffiti artist back then, and he actually gotten caught and you know, had to deal with some stuff. So he could not do the tours that were coming up. He didn't generally play on the records because he was like really crazy. He was just a guy who wanted to jump around and have fun live. But the reason I'm telling you all that stuff with the battery stuff is because that kind of turned into the Better Than a Thousand formula in a way later. But let me back up one more moment. With Graham, when he calls me up, he's like, yeah, I'm back. And I said, man, it is perfect that you're back. Battery, we just recorded this record. We got this whole tour coming up. We got this whole schedule coming up. You know, if you're down, you should just jump into Battery. And I mean, he probably called me and 2 or 3 days later, we're buying plane tickets and I'm showing him the song. And I mean, he jumped right into Battery. And just in time, like we literally probably took photos for that record like a week after and then, you know, maybe 6 weeks later, we're touring. And that tour that he did, I felt bad for him because the tour that he did, he jumped right into it. And it was like, I just saw a picture of the tour of a t-shirt somebody posted. It's like a 2.5 month tour. So he jumped in and it was like, it starts in the winter. It goes right deep into the spring and almost summer. And it was like, man, you didn't know you signed up for the, you know, probably the longest hardcore tour.
Single tour.
That any of us had ever done. So anyway, so Graham jumped into Battery. And so we actually were very active with Battery from like 96 and 97. And then right around 97, Brian starts a new band. And it looked like they were going to really, really be very, very active. They signed to a big label. And that label, you know, we kind of got into some of the stuff with Ray later with Roadrunner. But, you know, a big label does not want to spend a lot of time and money investing in a bunch of artists. And basically trying to build them up. And meanwhile, these guys' main band is someplace else, you know? So they don't really they don't mind if you're doing something kind of small and low key, but they don't really want you putting a lot of energy into something else when they maybe are spending a lot of money and time building you up. So that was a situation with Brian's band. He had started a band called Milltown out of the Boston area. And, you know, all great guys, great musicians, and great songwriter. So that looked like it was going to do a lot at the time. And Brian, you know, he said, yeah, I might not have as much time to do Battery. He might not have any time. So, but me and Graham were thinking, you know, Battery was like a lot of fun for us. So we're sitting here thinking, man, it's, you know, that's awesome for Brian, but we got to keep doing hardcore. We're going to have to do something different. You know, Battery's over or could be over. We got to come up with something else. So, Graham's like, well, you know, I've been working on some songs. And I said, okay, great. You know, so at that time, he still lived, you know, right up the street. So he basically walks over and we start demoing songs. You know, we maybe had, I think we started with 5 songs. I demoed them at my house. And then we started trying out singers. And we were trying out, you know, we'd have, you know, all of our friends who we thought thought, you know, who they look like they might be able to front a band, and you see them and they got a lot of energy and we'd record them.
Do you try out anybody that either was in another band or ended up in another band?
Yeah, a couple guys. I mean, not, you know, they were like the, you know, local bands in DC, not bands that really you would know necessarily, but friends of ours, you know, who seem like they might be able to do it. And, you know, like it wasn't, nothing was bad. It just wasn't like magical, you know what I mean? And we were still, we felt like, well, we haven't quite found that guy yet, but we're going to keep looking. And then, at some point we just got to this point where we had gone through maybe like six or seven people. And Ray must have said something for some weird reason. He percolated back up. And at this point, you know, whenever Ray's in town, we hanging out with them. You know, Shelter's on tour a lot. I mean, Mantra's happening at this point. And he's saying, and Ray says, he's like, yeah, man, you know, I'd love to do it. You know, and then it was like that seed had been planted, you know, a couple of years earlier, and now it's like, you know what, we're not going to be able to do this band much if we do it with Ray, but at least it'll be as good. You know, this is one of the best, if not the best hardcore singer of all time. You know, for that style of music, you know, it's hard to think of who's better, you know, not only from a, you know, I mean, you know, he's writing certain style of lyrics, but live, it's like, he's, you know, probably the best hardcore front man live ever. You know, he's just so acrobatic and, you know, so energetic. Like it's, you know, I was in a lot of bands and it's just, you know, it's unusual. The guy is just like, you know, when he hits that one button, I mean, yeah. You know,
plus a top-notch entertainer on top of it.
Yeah, well, that's what it's like the full package, like you know, saying this meaningful, heartfelt lyrics that touch people, no question, you know, from all his bands, you know, but then on top of it, when you bring it live, it just goes to this other place that, you know, very few people have ever had all those pieces in. So, you know, Graham and I, you know, we grew up listening to Youth of Today. We, you know, he was in Shelter with them, and we know Ray, we're friends with him. So we, you know, we had the personal side. We, you know, he's our friend too, on top of everything else. And, you know, we always had fun hanging out with him, you know? So it was very easy to call him up, say, you know what, let's do it. Hear the songs. And
he did it straight away. He said yes straight away.
He jumped right into it. It was, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, I want to say, I think they had this huge, when we asked him, they had this huge Shelter tour on the calendar. We had a huge Shelter, and we had this short, very short window. Like when we figured out when we could do it, I mean, from the day we talked to him, we maybe had like a month. But here's the other thing. We only had five songs recorded. So we sent Ray those five. And then we jumped back in the studio, record the rest of this, what ended up being the Just One album, which is probably another seven tracks. So those two sessions those songs are from two separate recording sessions. But then Ray comes in at the end and sings over all of them. And I mean, it was like super chaotic because we had this short window, and if we didn't finish, you know, he's about to go on like, you know, 12, 14 months nonstop touring on Mantra, you know? And so he managed to squeeze in, and so we got it done. But, you know, I think, I mean, you can hear how crazy it is. If you actually listen to the songs, like his voice was blown on, you know, three or four of the songs. And I mean, it was ridiculous.
I mean, I went back to the record a few days ago, and is, you know, the way the track list is on the album, is that the order you recorded them to?
Well, you know, it probably was, because we definitely would have wanted the songs that came out the strongest, and also the ones we were more, you know, like the songs that he was able to spend more time on. You know, because, you know, we give Ray, if you hand him, you know, 10 songs, there's going to be a bunch he just like immediately is feeling and whips out. And then there's some, it's like, well, I'm still working on it. And then there's some at the end, it's like, you know, he's finishing lyrics, like he's in the booth. I mean, there were songs where, and I mean, this is just a general thing that some singers do. You see this a lot with hip hop artists, for example, but there are singers who will go in the booth and literally be writing lines while, you know, like they'll put their verse together or some part of the verse together while they're recording. You know what I'm saying? So there's all, you know, and I mean, it's funny because, you know, Ray handed us a book of his lyrics when, you know, here's the lyrics, and you can't, his handwriting was so, he's writing so fast because he's in the booth coming up with the ideas. It's like, they look like hieroglyphics to me, you know, like, I don't know what language that is. Maybe it's Sanskrit. I don't know. But I could barely decipher them, you know, and it was crazy.
Was Graham the main songwriter as far as the music went, since he played guitar on all those songs?
So on Just One, Graham is writing all the music and I'm the drummer. And the only thing I'm doing is sort of directing, sort of, you know, what has to happen. You know, like, he'll write the riffs. I'll write and arrange the songs with him and come up with some cool parts. But I mean, Graham is the, I don't think I wrote any of the music on Just One.
Okay. And did Ray write all the lyrics? Because if you check the original liner notes in Just One, it says lyrics by Better Than 1,000. Or did all of you contribute to?
Yeah, we all contributed. Ray wrote, you know, 65%. But we were all, because it was such a crazy time constraint, we're all writing together. We're all writing them in the studio. There was no way for one guy to write them all in the little amount of time that he had. So, and, you know, we all basically have similar mindsets. You know, I mean, it wouldn't be hard for me to write lyrics that, you know, that would make sense for Ray to be singing, you know? And, you know, it was definitely a team effort. I mean, this was, on a personal note, you know, Graham, most of my bands, I would be either the only guy writing the music or I'd be writing 97% of it. Anything I had done. So this was the first time for me. It was like, oh, I don't really have to, I can just be like a guy playing in the band, you know, like that was a really cool, you know, that was like, normally I'd have to worry about, you know, recording and all this other logistic stuff and maybe some management style stuff. Cause I'm kind of a, you know, a guy who's, you know, working, you know, pushing the, you know, making the calls and reaching out, trying to make things happen for the band. But to not have to deal with the writing was like, made it so easy and painless for me, you know, so I could focus on other things, you know, with the band. And that was great. That was great. And so that record, you know, it came together. It's, you know, again, the thing that was weird is that when we first went, it was a demo. So all of a sudden it's turning into a record, and all of a sudden it's turning into a record with Ray Capo singing. And it's like, oh man, you know, this is really grown. And it's sort of a lesson in, you know, you don't really know where something's going to end up. So it makes sense to put your best foot forward, you know, and mm-hmm. kind of put that maximum effort in to, you know, at the time it felt like, oh, this is, you know, there's things that I probably would have liked to have, you know, you might've done that extra take, or you might've, you know, thought about this or that.
I mean, it's crazy. If you listen all the way through, and especially the last song, Apology, like, you literally, if you know, you hear Ray's voice blowing out. It's amazing, though. But it's also, it adds to the atmosphere and to the charming of the record, I think.
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, the one thing I'll say is we weren't trying to be something that we weren't. You know, we were a bunch of hardcore kids who wanted to just do a hardcore record. We wanted to keep it simple and capture just whatever that raw energy was. And, you know, we definitely did those things, you know, like, you know, maybe it was too raw sometimes, but it was cool to not have, you know, in an era of studios where you can always have these perfect takes. It's like, you know, you go see a band live, you know, the singer, a guy who's been on tour for a week already, and his voice is half blown out anyway. And, you know, I mean, this is kind of what it's really like. Like, you know, like, these are real guys. This is really the level of their musicianship.
Mm-hmm. Did you then already, like, back then, did you go label shopping with it? Or you mentioned that, you know, Ray at that point, he's in Shelter, he's signed to, you know, a really big record company. He has this successful band. Like, what was the process after you finished the record and trying to get it out?
It was, I want to say we had that thing. We told, you know, back then there's literally two or three labels, you know, for hardcore. That, you know, I mean, there are more, don't get me wrong. And there's tons of smaller labels. But, you know, when you think of like marquee labels, you thought of, you know, for that style, old school New York City style hardcore, you think of Revelation, of course, you think of Victory, you think of Equal Vision. Those would be like the three dominant labels in like the mid-90s hardcore scene, mid to late 90s. And obviously with Ray's background and Youth of Today and having been on Rev and the first Shelter Records on Rev, that was our first stop. Now when Ray got done, I sent, because I knew all those guys also. I mean, some of my bands had either been on some of those labels or we knew all those guys. And so we had already said, you know what, we're not going to spend a lot of time. We sent a copy to Victory and we sent a copy to Jordan at Revelation. So Tony at Victory and Jordan at Rev both got it. And they both expressed interest right away. And I have to say, you know, Jordan just like got back to us super fast. And actually it was weird because it wasn't like a bidding war or anything. Like for whatever reason, they both labels got it. They would have got it the same day. And for whatever reason, Jordan just got back in touch with us so fast. I mean, called us and so I want it. What do I need? You know, what do I need to send you guys? Like we actually did that record with no contract, believe it or not. He just like said he wanted it. And actually it was kind of crazy because Tony, you know, a day or so later, he's like, oh, I definitely want the record too. And he actually had offered a lot more for the record, but we had already committed to Rev, you know? So we weren't even trying to do like a, you know, bidding war or anything like that. It was just like, it didn't really matter which of the labels had put it out from a, you know, we just needed to get this record out. Obviously there was a lot of history with Revelation, so that was pretty cool. And that was the first for an old school hardcore kid who grew up buying 7-inches, like the first Sick of It All 7-inch, you know, literally the first couple 7-inches on Rev in the mid and late 80s, you know, that Rev Star had, you know, some special meaning to me. Worlds Collide was already on Victory. And Victory was kind of my generation of hardcore. So, I mean, like, both labels at the time, and we knew both guys, and both labels could have put the record out and done a good job with it. But the Rev Star had a little more meaning to me as like an old school hardcore kid who grew up going into shops buying those first 7-inches as just a music buyer before I was even in bands, you know. So that was cool. So that was a cool thing. It's like, oh, I'm on Revelation, you know, it's this label, that this iconic hardcore label back then.
Did anybody at that point even bother to talk to Roadrunner?
Ray did. He had his rep at Roadrunner. He had cleared it with him, and he had just gotten the kind of casual, you can do it as long as, you know, it doesn't get in the way. And so that was fine because at that point, it really didn't seem like we'd be able to do much. So we managed to squeeze in a first show because we knew, okay, now we knew at this point, it's like, and everything's happening insanely fast. I mean, this is inside of months, you know, like we're finishing the record. Okay, now it's on Rev. Okay, now we got to put the band has never played and we need some photos, you know, like the band hasn't played. So we had nothing out. We had not released, you know, this is pre-internet, I guess, and or internet in the sense of MP3s. You know, you couldn't just email somebody some songs. Now, what happened, which I didn't realize at the time, we had made some of our immediate friends copies of a handful of the songs on CD. Like we gave some of our buddies CD copies in, you know, maybe the 2 or 3 weeks before the show. And some of those guys had made a lot of copies. I mean, just like, I don't know how many. I mean, when the show actually happened, it seemed like the record had been out for months and everybody had it. I mean, it was really weird. And see, these are things you could not know. Everybody at that show seemed like had those songs. And so when we played, it looked like the record had been out for months and everybody knew the words. And I mean, the photos, you can just tell it's just that, you know, the last song of the set was insane. I mean, the whole crowd is on the stage, pushed up against my drum kit. you can see every member of the band right outside of the cymbals, you know.
And there's actually the back cover of Just One.
That's the back cover of Just One. Yeah. And a bunch of photographers were behind the kit because that was the only place that you wouldn't just have been balled over. So they're taking photos from behind the kit. And then, so one of those photos is that, you know, they're right behind me taking the photo, looking down on what's happening. But I mean, you know, playing drums, it was crazy because, you know, I'm sitting low. So I'm looking up and there's like, there's guys stage diving or crowd, you know, crowd surfing across, like just right, you know, like I'm hitting a cymbal, but the cymbal's not ringing because there's like a shoe touching the cymbal. I mean, it's funny from, you know, like you don't normally see that. I played a lot of hardcore shows. You know, I have seen some crazy shows, but that was one of the crazy shows I'd ever even seen. Forget about playing, you know, just because people were so hyped, they knew the words. And they were just, you know, the whole place went nuts. You know, we had made some, maybe, I don't know, 60 or, you know, maybe 6-7 dozen of those shirts. They were gone in 5 minutes. I mean, just the whole thing just was just a very hyped, eventful day. And, you know, it's like I said earlier, like I started getting the indication, like, okay, this might be a little special. There's a little magic. But then that show made me, that's when I said, okay, this is you know, right from the beginning, it's as good as hardcore gets.
Thank you very much for listening to the End Hits podcast. If you enjoyed this episode as much as we did, please send us feedback, share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, or give us a review. Stay safe and take care.